Jew, Professor Levine, who's going to speak on Rabbi Israel Salanter, who was a revolutionary par excellence, but we don't know yet which revolution.
Thank you, Harold. Which revolution? We will hopefully make that clear. I think if this goes in here, hopefully it will work.
You'll hear your heartbeat.
No, not from this. Who says I have a heart that actually beats? In any case, as Harold has said, the topic is Rabbi Israel Salanter, or as he's known in Hebrew, Israel in Hebrew is Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, 1810 to 1883, and I called him a revolutionary rabbi par excellence. And hopefully that will become clear why I have chosen to title him that way. His real name was Israel Lipkin, L-I-P-K-I-N. He was called Salanter because he lived in the city of Salant, or Salantai, which is a small town in Lithuania. And he was founder of something called the Musar Movement. That's a Jewish ethics movement. Now, to the outsider looking at Orthodoxy, as I guess to the outsider looking at any sort of group that's part of a certain religious denomination, everybody looks the same. But the fact of the matter is that there are differences within Orthodoxy. There are Hasidim, there are non-Hasidim, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter represents a tradition that has influenced Judaism for generations. He was born in a place called Zagari. It's a small northern Lithuanian town. His father earned his living by tutoring boys, and his father tutored him until the age of about 12. He was a child prodigy in that he was able at the age of 10 to deliver what are called innovations in Torah, in Talmud, at a very early age. And at 12, his father sent him to study with a Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Brody, who lived in Salant, and Rabbi Yisrael, Rabbi Salanter, spent a good chunk of his life there. He wrote his own innovations in Jewish law already at the age of 14. He was engaged at 14 to Esther, the daughter of Rabbi Yaakov Halevi Eisenstein. It was not unusual in those times to get engaged early. It's not unusual in certain cultures to get engaged early. He and his wife had four sons and two daughters. And when they got married, he made a deal with his wife. And the deal is based on the Talmud, in which the Talmud says that a woman's primary responsibility should be for the materialistic aspects of life, and the man should serve as a spiritual leader. So they made a deal. All things that are spiritual or overall spiritual are his province, and she takes care of the materialistic things within that framework. The story goes two ways. One story says that they never found anything that was purely materialistic. Throughout the entire course of their marriage, there was nothing that was ever purely materialistic. Another part of the story goes that after 10 years, she said, hey, we have to renegotiate because there's been nothing that's materialistic purely. And so I don't know exactly what's the true story, but in any case, it gives you an idea of the approach that they took. She ran a small business, and he spent the next 18 years of his life studying intensely. He gained fame as a genius who had a phenomenal mastery of Jewish learning, Torah learning, Talmud, Gemara, all of the things that are involved, Jewish law. He planned to live a private, quiet life in which he would devote himself to study and service of God. And that was indeed his plan, and he began to memorize the entire Talmud, which is a huge, huge undertaking with all of the commentaries that are to be found. It's over 30 volumes, with the idea that he would pursue some sort of simple manual labor, and at the same time, he would be able to study. But he decided, he changed his mind. He felt that if people were capable of influencing others, they had no right to live in seclusion. So he took on, little by little, a public role. In 1840, his wife's business collapsed. And just then, he was offered the position of joint head of a rabbinical school of a yeshiva in Vilna. Now, Vilna is in Lithuania. Vilna is a famous town, according to Judaism. Vilna was called the Jerusalem of Lithuania. It was a place that was filled with rabbinical scholars. Vilna was the place where the Gaon of Vilna, with Rabbi Elijah Hagon, Elijah Kramer, famous rabbi, lived. Rabbi Kramer, rabbi, the Vilna Gaon, as he was called the Vilna Gaon. Gaon means genius. He was called the Vilna Gaon. He slept 2 hours in 24. He slept 4 half-hours in 24, and the rest of the time he spent studying. Interestingly enough, the one book that was published during his lifetime was a book on geometry and trigonometry that he wrote. That was the one book that was published. When Rabbi Yisrael, Rabbi Salanta, got to Vilna and he began to give classes, he created a tremendous stir, because his breadth of knowledge and his depth of knowledge was astounding even to those who were exceptional scholars. He was able to put together in a single discourse and relate topics from all sorts of places that seemed to have nothing in common. To give you an idea of the breadth of his knowledge, and by the way, in general, he tried to hide it. His whole approach was to reveal little, as little, only as much as was necessary. He was once asked to give the conclusion talk on having concluded the entire Talmud. This is a huge effort. And what he did was, he began with the first volume, the first Masechta, and tied it to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. He spoke for 6 hours. How the people listened, I do not know. Of course, it's before television, it's before radio. These were entertaining. And it was astounding, his breadth of knowledge. Later, he was found depressed. What's the matter, they asked him. He said, I was a clown. I showed off my knowledge. There was absolutely no need for it. In any case, it came to his attention. He had been appointed to head with someone else a rabbinical school. And it came to his attention that he was completely overshadowing the other fellow. So what was his solution? He resigned. He resigned and began giving classes in a different place. He was supported by a businessman. Also, his wife opened a small business. But he wasn't content with simply being a teacher of rabbinical students, of Jewish students. And he organized public gatherings of the masses. He was very concerned with the masses. And he gave inspirational addresses that were designed to imbue his listeners with a closeness to God. He felt that Judaism had become mere format, rigor, and he was very much opposed to that. He felt that Judaism should be something that was living, and in particular, as we shall see, he was very concerned with one's relationship to one's fellow man. This was an overriding concern. He felt that one's relationship with God should be reflected in one's relationship to man. He started something called Musar. Musar means ethical approaches, to improve oneself, to study how one can improve one's character traits, how one can improve one's life in dealing with other people, with the world. He stressed character perfection, and he also founded something that was called a Musar House, a place where people could go and reflect and study certain traditional texts and work on their character improvement. His maxim was, not everyone who can should speak in public, but everyone who does should know how. And he could speak. He could speak. Now, he was in Vilna. He had no official position because he had resigned from the rabbinical college. He did have students. And in 1848, there was a cholera epidemic in Vilna, and the people were dying like flies. Reb Yisrael felt that it was his responsibility to do whatever he could to help the sick, and he sprung into action. Now keep in mind, he's a man with no money, no real resources, no real base, but he rented a hospital. I don't know how he managed to get the money to rent the hospital. He rented a hospital with 1,500 beds. He raised funds for this endeavor. He got the doctors to agree to care for the sick for free. He gathered 60 to 70 of his students, young men, unmarried men, and he had them care for the sick. I don't know if you are familiar, but we have throughout many Orthodox Jewish communities something called Hatzolah. You have it in New York, you have it in Muncie, you have it in a lot. Hatzolah is a volunteer ambulance service, and they know the guys who do this get nothing for it, except they don't get to sleep at night. And it's an amazing thing what they do. And you call them, anybody can call them, and they come, and they're known for coming much more quickly than the city ambulance or the fire department or whatever, and for giving really good care and taking people to the hospital. He, in a certain sense, laid the groundwork for Hatzolah. And he himself was everywhere, helping out. And in particular, when it came to the Sabbath. Now, there are restrictions on the Jewish Sabbath in terms of what one can do and what one cannot do. But when it comes to a matter of life or death, all Sabbath restrictions go by the by. You are allowed to violate everything. And he was, what'd you say?
Pork.
I don't know what that has to do with violating the Sabbath.
If you're starving to death.
If you're starving to death, yeah. Okay. Now, and he was in the forefront to show that one was allowed to do this and one should do this. He insisted that everyone obey the doctor's orders. And it got, this the epidemic went on, and it got close to the Jewish day of Yom Kippur. That's the fast day in the Jewish calendar when one is forbidden to eat according to the Bible. And he realized that certain people who were weak, if they actually fasted, it could be injurious to their health. First of all, he ruled that those who were weak should not fast. And he reduced the length of the prayers. He insisted, because there was no air conditioning, because there was no ventilation like we have today, he insisted that the prayers be abbreviated. And during the day, he went to the various synagogues and he insisted that people who were weak break their fast. And according to one version of the story, he stood up in the great synagogue in Vilna, and on Yom Kippur during the day, he actually ate in front of the entire group. Now, this created a stir in Vilna. It certainly saved people's lives, but there were many, many rabbanim with official positions who felt that he was overstepping his bounds. After all, who was he? He had no official position, and yet he had gone ahead and organized all this. He had, in a certain sense, risked the lives of these 60 or 70 men. He had insisted that people raise to that. So there was a storm of opposition. So Reb Yisrael Salanter announced that he was going to give a discourse the following week. So everybody thought he's going to talk about the question of what's called pekuach nefesh in Hebrew, of threat to one's life and Yom Kippur and this and that. He did not at all. He gave a discourse which was so dazzling, that was so mind-boggling, that all opposition was silenced. Silenced. There was an attempt on the part of, actually more than one attempt, there were many attempts on the part of the Russian government to try to wean the Jews away from Jewish observance. We're talking now in the 19th century. There was the forced induction in the army of Jewish boys. There were many things. One of the things the Russian government wanted was to start a rabbinical seminary, and they would educate what they call progressive rabbis. After all, the average Jewish rabbi at that time had really no minimal secular education. Okay, and they wanted to train secularly educated rabbis, and they felt, because of the approaches that Rabbi Salanter had taken, that he would be the obvious one to head such a seminary. He would have no part of it. He realized from the beginning that it was merely a ploy to destroy traditional Judaism, And as a result, in order to avoid being appointed, he left Vilna. And he went to a place called Kovna in Lithuania. That was in 1849. In Kovna, he also headed a seminary. He started a Musar movement again there, and he remained there for 9 years. And he was, in a certain sense, at the height of his career. He was recognized in the Jewish world, in the Torah world, as one of the top people in the Torah world. And then he did one of the most unusual, it's almost impossible to understand what he did. In 1858, he went to live in Germany. In Memel first, which is close to the Lithuanian border, then later in Königsberg. Why did he go to Germany? He knew that the reform movement in Germany had taken root. And while there were problems in Russia and Lithuania, there was a group called the Maskilim, the Enlightened Ones, who also were chipping away at traditional observance. Rabbi Yisrael felt that he could do the most in Germany. When he was once asked why he went to Germany, why he didn't concentrate on Russia and Lithuania, he said, "When a team of horses breaks away and they begin to run down a hill, it's almost impossible to stop them. Once they get to the bottom and slow down, then you have a chance of reining them in. Germany is at the bottom. At the bottom." And he did his best to stop the reform movement. He was involved with college students. He also went for 2 years to Paris. He spent 2 years in Paris. He had bold projects, although not all of them, in fact, a number of them were never put into action. He came up with the idea of translating the Talmud into European languages so that it would be taught on college campuses, and in that way the assimilated Jewish students would begin to think that was important. He published the first Torah journal ever. He had attempts to influence the Russian government. He had a student of his in St. Petersburg whose whole goal was to try to influence the Russian government to mediate its edicts against the Jews. I can't pass by when talking about Yisrael Salanter without mentioning one of his sons. He actually had 3 sons and 2 daughters, but he had 1 son, Lipman Lipkin, Yom Tov in Hebrew, Lipkin. And he turned out he became a mathematical physicist. At the age of 15, he left home. He went to college to study. Rabbi Yisrael was not happy at all because the child was a brilliant, brilliant Torah scholar. And in addition to that, as we will see from another example, the atmosphere in college was not at all conducive to religious observance. Anyway, Yom Tov Lipkin is famous because he disproved the conjecture of Chebyshev. Chebyshev had said that there was no way to convert circular motion into linear motion, and Lipkin built a device. It's called Lipkin's parallelogram. There was another fellow who did it at the same time. I think it's pronounced it's Pucellia Lipkin. P-E-U-C-E-L-L-I-E-R. Won't help me. Pucellier. Lipkin linkage. And actually, if anybody's interested, there's a website where you can see this thing and how it worked.
Actually, it's that second thing that is more commonly known.
Right. 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 And it's an interesting device. It's on the web and you can actually see it and how it does it. In any case, this son died at a young age at about 21, sadly enough.
You said earlier that he had 4 sons.
He had 3 sons and 2 daughters. One passed away at a relatively early age. I said 4?
Yeah.
I stand corrected. 3 sons, 2 daughters. 3 sons, 2 daughters. By the way, I want to point out, Harold asked me, do you have a picture of the rabbi? And I sent back, there is none. And I believe that's on purpose. I don't think he ever let his picture be taken. He was too... Everything was quiet. Everything was done in the background. Only when necessary did he come out publicly, did he do things publicly. This was not his style at all. We do have a picture of one of his sons who they claim looks like him, but there's actually no picture. There's only a description that we have in a book of what he looked like, that he was always immaculately dressed, and he was very careful about his appearance, very careful about how he dealt with people. Now, we have a zillion stories about Reb Yisrael Salanter to illustrate the type of man. Because, all right, he was a great Talmudic scholar, he was head of a rabbinical seminary, etc. But what was he? What was he? What was it that was unique about him? Reb Yisrael Salanter never occupied any public office. He was neither a businessman nor an artisan. He belonged to none of the categories that the Russian government considered eligible to obtain a passport legally. In order to travel, he used the passport of a merchant friend. Reb Yisrael's pure character did not allow him to keep up this unlawfulness for long. When he visited Berlin in the early 1870s to seek a cure for his ailing health, this aging man of 63 or so decided that he would not travel home until he had learned a skill that would enable him on his return to Russia to obtain a legal passport. It seemed to him that the easiest and most promising skill to learn was ink making. And he took lessons from a chemist. A friend gave him a whole floor in his house to use as a laboratory. For weeks, Reb Yisrael occupied a good part of his day and his nights with intensive theoretical and practical study of chemistry. This was not as easy as it sounds. He and his chemistry teacher could, at first, only communicate with each other through an interpreter. But Reb Yisrael learned to read and write German and soon progressed so far that he could read the daily paper. With some help for the more difficult words and the chemical terms, he was soon able to study chemistry books. A few weeks later, Reb Yisrael understood the composition of all types of ink, including gold and silver ink. He had accomplished his goal so rapidly and so thoroughly that his chemistry teacher declared that his elderly chemistry student had nothing more to learn from him. That's how far he went. Was very concerned to follow the letter of law. Now, you have to understand something. The law in Russia was definitely discriminatory towards Jews. It's a huge amount of anti-Semitism. Jews had to pay double taxes. The life of Jews in Russia was terrible. That's why they came here by the hundreds of thousands. It was terrible in Russia for Jews. Another example of Reb Yisrael. When he had yeshiva in Vilna, he always took pains to come on time. Believed in starting on time. Yet once, it had become very late and he had not yet come. Concerned, his students went outside to look for him. When they reached the bridge leading to the city, they noticed him standing deep in conversation with a young woman. They understood that he was occupied with some grave matter and withdrew. When he finally entered the yeshiva, Reb Yisrael apologized for being so late, but explained that a matter of life and death had detained him. The students subsequently investigated, and finally the details of the incident were pieced together. On his way to the yeshiva, he was about to cross the bridge when he suddenly noticed an excited woman rushing towards the river. He stood in her way, stopped her, and asked her why she was running. She tried to pass by him and told him to leave her alone. Reb Yisrael grasped her by the sleeve and repeated his request that she tell him what the matter was. Forced to remain where she was, she unfolded her tale of woe. A short while ago, her two children were taken ill and had died a few days later. So overcome with grief was her husband that he had been unable to work for the past several weeks. They had been forced to hire somebody else to drive their wagon, and in this way managed to subsist and cover the costs of the husband's illness. Suddenly the horse died. Their sole means of support was gone. In despair, she had decided to throw herself into the river. Reb Yisrael talked to her at length. Tenderly and softly, he explained to her that God could only make good her deficiencies. She was still young. A year from now, she could bear another child, and so on. Her husband would recover and resume his occupation. As for the loss of the horse, he would send her money for another the next day. Slowly, the woman became pacified and regained her composure. She thanked Reb Yisrael for the goodness of his heart and returned home. A year later, Reb Yisrael was invited to attend this ritual circumcision of her newly born son. His concern was unbelievable. He was interested also, he was an innovator, and he was interested in trying to stop the erosions that were going on within Orthodoxy. And he felt that he needed to develop secularly educated observant Jews. During the 19th century, there were those who came to believe that anyone who had received an advanced secular education as being on a higher level and therefore not expected to obey the commandments of the Torah, as did the rank and file. Rabbi Yisrael endeavored to eradicate this popular misconception and to produce secularly educated, God-fearing Torah scholars. This would be the weapon against what they call the species of the maskilim, those who considered themselves to be enlightened. These were Jews who had become very secularized, who considered the fear of God and enlightenment to be mutually exclusive, and who looked with contempt on Judaism. He conducted an experiment, extremely audacious for the climate of opinion of those days. Now listen to the experiment. Choosing one of his outstanding disciples, so he went into the rabbinical school, and he picked a fellow who he had real confidence in, and his name was Isser Einhorn, and he sent him off to study in a secular institution. The student was most successful in a short time, graduated from the St. Petersburg Military Medical Institute. And he became a physician, a well-known physician, an outstanding physician. But he succumbed to temptation. Having attained high military rank, he abandoned his Judaism and converted to Christianity. Rabbi Slonta never forgave himself for that. Whole life, he was upset with himself. But you have to understand, you see, the atmosphere in the world then was so against observant Judaism, particularly in the secular world, that it was difficult for people to remain in that environment and also remain observant. He was not concerned with externalities. Another aspect of Rabbi Yisrael's personality must be mentioned, even though this would appear as purely external. Yet it stemmed from deep spiritual roots and is characteristic of Rabbi Yisrael's entire approach. Rabbi Yisrael, as has been said, did not wear rabbinic clothes. He didn't. In fact, there's a story. There's a Rabbi Moses Sofa. He's known as the Chassam Sofa. He's a famous Hungarian rabbi. And he had a couple of sons, and one of them, Rabbi Avram Sofer, took over his position after the father passed away. Now, these were well-educated rabbis. The son of the Chassam Sofer was known as the Ksav Sofer. One time he came back, he had been on vacation, he came back, and he was totally depressed. And he went into his home and he wouldn't talk to anyone, to no one. Finally, two or three days later, he told people what had happened. He said he was traveling on the train, and there was a simply dressed Jew. He looked like an ordinary layman or nothing. And he happened to get involved in a conversation with him about Torah topics, about Jewish topics. And this simple, poshet, as we say in Yiddish, Yid, wiped him out. He was devastated. He did not realize that that was Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, who went around looking like an ordinary person. No ears, no nothing. He did not recoil at times from wearing clothes that were unconventional for those learning the Torah in a particular environment. He used to relate that he once delivered an inspiring address in a town, and his listeners were deeply affected. Suddenly, as he descended from the platform, he noticed the local elders moving back from him upon noticing that he was wearing polished high boots, which was not the norm in those circles. Some add that he then went back on the platform and chastised them for being concerned about this rather than about what he said. He used to, when he went around to speak, he used to post the sources of the talk, what the talk was based on, say, 3 or 4 days before. And this was his practice. And then, so people could prepare if they wanted, and he would deliver a talk. A couple of fellows decided to play a trick on him. They changed the sources without telling him a few days before the talk. He came to give the talk. He asked for the paper with the sources. He looked at it, and he stood still for about 4 or 5 minutes. And then he delivered a brilliant talk on those topics. His student said, "Don't think that it took Rabbi Yisrael Salanta 5 minutes to make up a talk on those new topics. That was not what was bothering him. What was bothering him was the following. Should he just step down? Or should he divulge his greatness in Torah because he could make up an unbelievable talk on topics on the spot?" And this was his struggle. Finally decided that if he just stepped down, it would look like he was a nothing. So he did it. He was honest to a fault. Honest to a fault. He made no distinction between the laws between man and God and the laws between man and man, and even gave priority to the latter over the former. He regarded honesty in business and the preservation of the sanctity of someone else's property as occupying the highest level, and he found support for his evaluation in many rabbinic edicts. He had a saying, "Yenim's gashmius is your ruchnius." The other person's, I'm sorry, I have it just backwards. The other person's materialistic needs are your spiritual needs. Don't worry about his religious observance. Worry about if he has what to eat. Worry about if he has a job. Be concerned with his materialistic needs. That's your responsibility. He was careful always to say the prayer for the government, which is part of the ritual, or was part of the ritual in many, many Jewish synagogues. In places in Russia where the Tsar was known for his anti-Semitism, it was not such a favorite prayer, but he made sure to say it. Here's an example that gives, a story that gives a real insight into Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. Now, it's customary on the Jewish Sabbath to have festive meals. At these festive meals, in addition to good food being served, there are talks about religious topics, special songs are sung. It's like a holiday meal, but it's every week. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta was once traveling, and one of his students invited him to come and spend Friday night at his house. Now, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta was known, when it came to his own personal observance, to be extraordinarily strict. So the former student who was inviting him said to him, first he assured him that everything in terms of the food being kosher, he didn't have anything to worry about. He got his meat from such and such a place. The woman who worked in the kitchen was the widow of an old Talmud scholar, so she certainly knew what to do, and his wife came into the kitchen regularly to make sure that everything was done. And as far as the Sabbath table goes, they would eat a course, and then they would sing songs, and they would discuss various religious topics, and they would eat and sing songs, and usually the meal went till about midnight. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta tried to dodge going, but he was cornered, so he said, "I'll come on one condition. We come home after synagogue, we make what's called kiddush, which is the traditional blessing over wine. We wash, we eat bread, we eat the meal. No words of Torah, no zmiros, no religious songs. We just eat." Boom. What could the guy do? He agreed. After all, he's going to have Rabbi Yisrael Salanta as a guest. How could he not agree? Comes Friday night, they come home from synagogue, and it goes boom, 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 they're finished. Comes time for the blessings after the meal, and the host is just bursting, he can't understand. He says, "Rebbe," he says, "Rabbi, please, tell me, why is it that you insisted upon this? Why did you insist that no words of Torah, no words of wine?" So Israel says, "Call the cook in from the kitchen." The woman comes in, the old widow, and he says to her, "I have to apologize to you," he says. Every other week you have plenty of time to serve. This week you were rushed. You were rushed and rushed and rushed. He says, oh no, I wish you were here every Friday night. Every Friday I'm here from early in the morning. I'm standing on my feet and I'm cooking and I'm falling off my feet. And then I have to wait until they finish and it's midnight and I have to clean up. And by the time I go home, I will fall dead in my bed. Tonight I'll be able to go home and rest. He said to the host, he said, that's the reason why. Don't be religious on somebody else's account. That was his principle. Interesting man. One of the things that is traditional in Judaism is that we celebrate the anniversary of the passing of a close relative. There's a prayer that's said called Kaddish. It's said for a close relative, in particular, a father, a mother, brother, a sister, child. Now, although today the custom is that many people say this prayer, this Kaddish prayer together, the actual Jewish law is that only one person is supposed to say Kaddish. One person. And there's a whole hierarchy of who gets to say, depending upon who you have, the what's called the yortzeit, the commemorative time for, and certainly a parent takes precedence. And where Rabbi Israel Salanter prayed, he had instituted that people follow, there's still some places that still follow this custom of only one person saying. He had yortzeit, was a commemoration of the anniversary of the death of his father. And the fellow came in who had, it was the yortzeit of his daughter, commemoration of the death of a child, a young child. Now, according, he wanted to be able to say the Kaddish. And according to Jewish law, Rabbi Salanter was the one who had the, what's called the Kadima. He took precedence. But when Yisrael Salant, and the people told this fellow, he said, you know, Rabbi has, and it's his father, and then the guy began to get excited, upset. Rabbi Yisrael Salant said, let him say the Kaddish. So afterwards they asked him, Rabbi Yisrael, you have for a father, he has for a daughter, you come first. You daven here, you pray here regularly, he comes in only once in a while, you come first. Why? He said, I felt it was a bigger, how do you say, schus, a bigger positive thing for the soul of my father to avoid hurting this person and let him say Kaddish rather than me. He had an overriding concern for others. He was amazed that people were oblivious to the weighty obligation devolving upon them to bring benefit to others and who treated their responsibility so lightly. People go out of their way to confer the merit on others to perform some commandment, but never take the trouble to make others happy. Many times he would say, I have seen a person pass by a synagogue, and those inside will call him in and say, come, come, make the minyan, come, come and make the minyan. He says, but I never saw anybody open the door and say, dinner is served, come on in, time to eat. Didn't do that. People didn't do that. Even in his passing, he was concerned for others. According to Jewish law, a dead body is never left alone. In fact, I saw in an email this morning, this professor, is it Levesiu? How do you pronounce it? Levesiu is the way you pronounce it. So it has been worked out. In fact, now, actually soon, the funeral, there'll be a funeral in Borough Park for him, and then he'll be flown to Israel. But it was quickly worked out. His son in Israel contacted is an organization called Zaka. Zaka is an organization in Israel that goes around when after people are blown up, they collect the body parts because we bury everything. That's what they do. They're involved in these grisly aspects of death. And from there in Israel, they contact somebody in Muncie, who contacted somebody here and somebody there so that they could, first of all, make sure there was no autopsy. We, Jewish law, unless there's really an overriding reason, forbids autopsy. There was no real overriding reason. They agreed that they would remove the bullets, and that was all that they had to do. And then they arranged also for somebody to come and to spend and to be with the body, a rabbi who was not so far away, and then to have the body flown to Brooklyn, etc. When Israel was on his deathbed, so what would a man like Rabbi Salanter be thinking about? Wouldn't he be thinking about making his peace with his maker? about confessing whatever sins he might have thought he had, whatever. That wasn't his concern. At least it wasn't his main concern. There was a simple fellow with him. And he saw, because he knew it was close to the end, that the fellow he felt would be uncomfortable being around a dead body. So he spent his last moments explaining to this fellow that you have nothing to fear when I pass away. Nothing will happen to you. I'll be gone, but there's absolutely nothing to fear. That's how Rabbi Yisrael Salanter spent his last days. The other person's materialistic needs are your spiritual needs. Thank you.
I'd like to exercise my right to be the first speaker. In fact, was he a Yiddish speaker?
Of course. What else would he speak?
I don't know. You didn't mention it. You mentioned his Hebraic, his studies.
Well, but sure, that was the language that was used.
And, yeah. Secondly, Larry mentioned the point that his son invented what he called a parallelogram for converting rotary motion into linear motion. But 70 years previous to that, James Watt invented what is called the parallel motion for the purpose of converting rotary motion into linear motion. And I suspect it's essentially
probably
the same device. Neither of them, I know for certain, and I assume for Lipkin, I think he said, neither of them analyzed it mathematically. It's a very, very difficult problem in kinematic analysis. They simply designed it. It has since been analyzed, and it does not convert strictly into vertical motion. James Watt used it for the purpose of having the piston rod in a steam engine move vertically. It doesn't move quite vertically. For practical purposes, it's good enough, but actually, it defines a very, very narrow figure eight. That's point two. Point three, you mentioned that at the bottom of the hill, he went to restrain the horses. In other words, to resist some of the trends of the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment. I'm just wondering if you or other historians have also, evidently, I would think the answer is yes, have seen him in the context of the Haskalah, some of his respect for secular knowledge and so on.
Let me comment on that. Yes, that's a good point. He was not opposed to secular knowledge per se. Okay? He was not opposed. He was in the tradition of the Vilna Gaon. The person he looked upon as his main teacher had been a student of the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon claimed that he had mastered all secular knowledge except for animal husbandry and philosophy and one other discipline. It could well be that he had, although my friend Leon Ehrenpreis says that there's a mistake in his geometry book. So Eliezer Ehrenpreis says that you can probably, he said there's a mistake, but okay. He wasn't opposed to secular knowledge per se. What he was concerned about was the atmosphere that one had to, in general, go into if one went to a university. He himself was seen spending hours in libraries investigating things when he needed certain scientific knowledge. Now, it's interesting that those, the maskilim, those who were involved with the Haskalah, looked upon him with great favor. They looked upon most other rabbis with contempt. Literally with contempt. They spewed out all sorts of things against the rabbis, but Salanter was untouchable because he had this approach. But he would never have considered himself part of the Haskalah. Never.
Fourthly, you promised to say which revolution. To some extent, it sounds to me like the socialist revolution, all this respect for...
It's a revolution within Judaism. It's a revolution, it's a focusing on something that had gotten lost. And you have to understand that this tradition, he had a number of students who then had students of their own, and they started within the yeshiva movement, within the Jewish education movement, this Musar movement was propagated, and they trained many, many people, and it all goes back to him. So he was a revolutionary in the sense that he rejuvenated, he reinvigorated Judaism. In a certain sense, although I'm not of the Hasidic bent, but one can say that the Hasidic movement also, to some extent, did that with Judaism.
Fifthly and finally, you mentioned one fault that he had, namely honesty. Did he have another?
If anything, he didn't. He never gave himself enough credit. He never felt that he was really anything special. He was extraordinarily modest. That's right. He was very, very modest. If he were to come in here, he might look like one of the college students.
He has two faults, honesty and modesty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same as you.
Sir.
Two things. You mentioned at the end of his life he was concerned about the president had simply his corpse being frightened by it or something.
Yes, yes, yes.
Are you sure? You know, I'll be dead, so I won't bite you, and so on and so
right,
on.
Right.
And you also told the story about how one day he was always so punctual, and one day he was not there at the time for the class, or whatever it was, and all the students said, oh, where could he be? He's always so punctual. And they looked into it, and they discovered that he was saving the life of some woman who had thrown up a bridge. My two questions are, why did his students investigate where he was and not just take his word for it? And why was he left alone with an utter stranger when he died?
Why was he left alone with the strength? Yeah, okay. First question is, why did his students investigate? Because they wanted to learn from him and his way of life and what he did. And he hid most things. And the best teacher is example. But if you keep it hidden, it's not so easy. So they were curious to know. First of all, let's understand something. For a rabbi to be seen holding the arm of a woman in public is not common, to put it mildly. Okay? To put it mildly. So this was something that they were fascinated to know. There is somebody called the Alta of Slabodka. He is a student of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel had a yeshiva in Slabodka, in Lithuania, it's near Kovna, and he trained many of the previous generation's great rabbis. The Alta of Slabodka used to disappear periodically. Disappear. They wondered, where did he go? He disappeared. Disappeared. They once followed him. Where did they find him? They found him amongst a group of gypsies conversing with them. So later they said to him, Rebbe, what are you doing? He said, look, gypsies are the most forlorn of people. Nobody wants to have anything to do with them. It's our obligation to try to enliven, to make other people happy. I'm there to make them happy. So that's why they investigated. They wanted to learn. Now, the other question was, why was Rabbi Yisrael Salanta alone? In the Hasidic world, the Hasidic leaders traveled with entourages. With huge, even today, with followers, with people who lead the way and who guard the way, it's almost like the President of the United States in a certain sense. Rabbi Yisrael was not that at all. One of the earlier Lubavitcher Rebbes once was in a certain place where Rabbi Yisrael Salanta was staying, and he was told Rabbi Yisrael Salanta is in this room, so he opened the door and he looked, and there was nobody there but Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. He said, where's your following? I have no following. He was a simple man. When he died, by the way, he owned nothing, because he lived for many years off of the generosity, off of the charity of other people, and he felt he had to cut his expenses to the minimum. He didn't even own any religious books at the end of his life, because he felt that he had... So he was an extremist in a sense. Why was he alone? Because he wasn't... He didn't have an entourage with him.
Did he have family?
He had family, but he had gone away from his family. He was in Königsberg. His family, his wife had passed away at this time. His children were grown and married. And he passed away in Königsberg, which is not where his family, not in Lithuania, not where his family was. He had family.
That's right. I mean, it just seems to me it's so strange. On the one hand, you're telling us that he was so great. He was this. He was that.
Yeah, he had a tremendous influence.
Everybody, just everywhere, was so dazzled by him. And then he dies alone because his family is busy across town or something.
Not across town. Not across
the
first.
Across the country. I mean, they're trains. Come on.
Yeah, but this was at the moment of death, and all right, it's more than that. When he died, only recently did we find his tombstone. It was not known where his tombstone was even. He was this type, and he for example, when he, one of his daughters got married, he did not go to the wedding because he didn't feel it was right that he should borrow the money to go. Didn't have the money himself. He had nothing personally in a certain sense. And he was traveling. After all, he left home for many years.
So it was like a monk, poverty, chastity.
He had children, but he was later. Yeah, in the same.
He's traveling Hindu.
He devoted himself to what he felt was important, and to the exclusion of everything else. It's not a way of life for everybody, believe me.
Yes, I don't want to be. I mean, I'll stop now because I'm sure there are lots of other questions here. It's just that my point is, it's sometimes hard to distinguish between a rationalization and something else, a reason. For example, you said in response to my question, why did the students ask, "Where were you?" Why didn't they just take his word from him? He said, well, they wanted to learn. Well, yeah, they wanted to learn.
They
didn't want to learn from him because what he was trying to teach them was, you know, it doesn't matter.
No. They knew where he was. They had seen him on the bridge. They had seen him on the bridge, and then they left. But they wanted to know what he was doing there. I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear.
I apologize.
I'm sorry that I didn't tell the story well. They had seen him on the bridge. They went looking for him.
Oh my God, what's the rabbi doing holding my hand?
Yeah.
Now.
Okay.
I would ask too.
Anyone else?
I have a peripheral question. A couple of days ago, I saw a program about the Jews of Lithuania before the Second World War, and they all seemed to be speaking Yiddish, but to integrate into, did they try to integrate into the country and speak the national language also, Lithuanian? Do you know?
I know, and I'll answer. Okay, let's understand something. Because I have a friend who was born in Lithuania, who studied in yeshiva in Lithuania. He pointed out to me that in the 1920s, the Lithuanians passed certain anti-Semitic laws forbidding the Lithuanian population from doing business with the Jews. You couldn't make a living in Lithuania. They were dirt poor. So there was nothing to speak in terms of the language, okay? Because there was nobody to deal with. You couldn't deal with the population. That's number one. Number two, in general, in Russia too, Jews did not speak the language, many of them. Many of them, in other places they did, but in some places they didn't. But I'm going to add a little footnote here, which I found fascinating. The Jews in general spoke Yiddish, yet there's a woman by the name of Yaffa Eliak. Yaffa Eliak, if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., she is from Eisishok, which is a small Lithuanian town. And she escaped as a little child from the Holocaust, and she is a historian. She spent her life researching Eisishok, and she has a huge room there with pictures from Eisishok. She went all over the world collecting them. And I heard her speak once, and she said, "We spoke Hebrew in the home." Hebrew in the home? In Lithuania? Whoever heard of that? I didn't understand it. But then I understood what was going on. A higher percentage of Jews in Lithuania spoke Hebrew before World War II than in Israel. Interestingly enough, I interviewed Rebbetzin Ethel Miller, who is the widow of Rabbi Avigdor Miller, who I was close with, and she told me, "We studied Everything in Ivrit b'Ivrit, Hebrew into Hebrew. We studied not just the Jewish subjects. I studied algebra and geometry and trigonometry in Ivrit b'Ivrit. I said to her, now this is in the late 20s and early 30s. She went to a Yavne school, but worse than Kovna, and then in Ponovich. I said to her, Mrs. Miller, you mean Ivris b'Ivris, which is the Ashkenaz pronunciation. Oh, no, she says to me. We studied Ivrit b'Ivrit. That's how much it was. Now, you have to understand, there were three types of schools in Lithuania, besides the public schools. There were the Bund schools, which were the secular type schools. They were the Yiddish schools. But then the Mizrahi schools and the other Orthodox schools were essentially some Yiddish and Ivrit. Because as this friend of mine said to me, there was no hope in Lithuania. Zionism promised us a possible decent way of life. And the masses were entranced with it. So they didn't in general speak Lithuanian. They didn't speak Russian. They didn't speak Polish. Listen, I can take you to Williamsburg and introduce you to kids who were born here, their fathers were born here, and their grandfathers were born here, and they'll barely be able to say a sentence in English. I'm not saying it's right. I'll tell you this. When Rabbi Shimon Schwab, famous rabbi, came to America in 1936, became rabbi in Baltimore, he said in his home, he said, "We're in America, we speak English, no more German. We speak English. We're going to learn to speak English." And he forced himself to learn. And one of the great tragedies of American rabbis who came here in the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century was that they didn't learn the language. Rabbi Tyson Elizabeth, he understood this. He learned, he broke his teeth, but he learned English. Rabbi Schwab also, he broke his teeth, but he used to listen to Roosevelt on the radio to learn English. But in there they didn't. Anyone else? I thank you.